Second speaker tonight is Sharon M.
Hi, I'm Sharon, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Charlie for asking me here to speak tonight. It's a privilege to be at an AA meeting, and it's a privilege to be here. I'm an alcoholic. I've always had alcoholic solutions to all my alcoholic problems. And we were just talking when we got here. I grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey. And I, hey, come on. And I love Bayonne. You know, I love it. And we were talking, so I didn't get the lady's name, but we were talking to someone who was from Brooklyn. And she said, Bayonne? Bayonne is nothing. All it is bars. You know, makes sense. I'm here, right? And, you know, like the first two speakers, I also grew up in an alcoholic family. And my father, and I'm really the product of this family. I mean, there's no question that I am the product of this family. My father was a very belligerent alcoholic. My mother was a very, and I love my mother. I mean, this even gets into part of my story, as I really loved my mother. I love her a lot. But my mother was a long-suffering martyr, and as the product of one of the products of this union, I'm a belligerent, long-suffering alcoholic martyr, and it's made it very difficult for me to get sober. I'm one of those people who, you know, if there's anything like remedial AA, it's what I had to go through. Because I'm not one of the people who came into these rooms and said, I love it here, I feel at home. I came into these rooms and I hated it here, and I hated you people, and I hated listening to all the crap you talked about. I hated the whole business. You know, people would stand up at the microphone and say, there's so much love in these rooms. And I'd say, there's so much crap in these rooms. And, you know, they'd talk about all of this stuff, and it would just drive me crazy. And you have these little things, you know, that you get into. Like one of them that really got me big time was the footprints in the sand thing. And I thought, you know, this is like endless crap. These people can go on and on and on with this stuff. I started drinking at a very early age, probably around 12. You know, having grown up in an alcoholic household, I learned that you don't spill alcohol, that you don't waste alcohol. I will still sit in restaurants and watch people who are sipping, and it drives me crazy. Or I'll watch people who get up and leave a glass half full. Being the optimist that I am, they leave the glass half full. And that drives, as if it's any of my business, but it drives me crazy. Because I was taught, you don't waste alcohol. That's the bottom line. And I felt like I was one of those people all my life who never finished anything. But I can honestly say there was never a glass or bottle that passed through my hands that didn't get finished. And it, I would like to say, you know, I grew up, I was a kid in the 50s, and everything seemed so glamorous then, you know. And I'd like to say that I was a glamorous drinker. But my cousin, who's here visiting from New Jersey, was reminding me of a story today where I was sitting on the back of the bus, you know, the long seat across the back, and I had been drinking and eating, I think it was creamed herring. My cousin's nodding, it was creamed herring. And so since I'm in the back of this bus, I had to throw up in my shirt because I didn't, and this is as glamorous as it gets, you know. I'm telling you the good stuff here because this is as glamorous as it gets. And being back east and being in the winter, by the time I got home, it was all frozen to my chest. You know, so when I say my drinking was glamorous. The other parts of it that really stand out in my mind are how good a porcelain toilet felt against my face, or a tile floor in a restroom when I couldn't get up off of it. And I was a blackout drinker. So a lot of what I remember about my drinking came to me in the form of, do you know what you did last night? And the truth is, I didn't. You know, I didn't. I would never know how I got home. I would never know how I ended up with the people I ended up with, or what state I ended up in. It was pretty much, once I took the first drink, the rest of it was out of my control. And I understand fully what it talks with, the idea of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So, you know, my drinking was probably the same as all of your drinking. And what got me here, I was a geographic person. I moved to a lot of different states, and I was kind of moving to smaller and smaller places, fading out in them. And I had an opportunity to visit Los Angeles, and I loved it here. I realized that I wasn't dead. I was just resting, and L.A. was the place for me. And teamed up with someone who was a great drinker, and he would call in sick. He'd always have all these asthma attacks. You know, I can't come to work today. I'm having an asthma attack. And we would just drink all day, and it was wonderful. You know, it was great. And within 6 months, no, not even that. It was less for him. He was saying, I think I need help. And I'd look at him and go, ooh, yeah, you really need help. You know, you're in bad shape. And he came to AA. And I thank God that he came to AA, because, you know, it's how we work here. Because he would start saying, Sharon, why don't you come to a meeting with me? And I'm a giver. I mean, I'm a giver. I'll support a friend. And he just started slipping me into these meetings. And I thought they were really a good idea for him, and I hated them for myself. And I love it because, you know, I've had the opportunity to bring people who aren't alcoholics to AA meetings and to the open meetings, and they'll say, gee, that's great, these meetings are wonderful. And any time I've brought an alcoholic with me, they've said, I hate that. How can those people do that? And that, you know, that's just, it's like, to me, it makes sense that an alcoholic would come to AA and hate it. You know, I didn't trust anyone who didn't drink. I would always say I don't trust anybody who doesn't drink. And I grew up in that generation that said don't trust anybody over 40. And now I am that person. You know, I'm a person over 40 who doesn't drink, and I would have just probably despised me. And not really. I would have probably been afraid of me. You know, my drinking me would have probably been afraid of me. And maybe vice versa, because my drinking me was pretty mean. I don't know if I'd want to be in a room with me. So I came to this program, and I had a real tough time, and I am living proof. I know for a fact that you can come to AA and be as miserable as you want for as long as you want. You know, we can do that. That option is open to us. And I lasted for 2 years, sitting in the back of the room, scowling at you, judging you, judging your program, judging your God, judging everything. And, you know, nowhere in the big book does it say, if we judge someone just the right way, we'll stay sober. You know, it really talks about an inside job that we have to do. And I didn't get that at all. You know, I wanted something outside me to fix me. I was looking for the fix. And when it said, you know, they'd say in the meetings, if we have what you want, I'm a little nervous and I'm not a good quoter anyway, but if you see what you want, what is it? You know what I'm talking about. And I would look around the room and I would say, oh yeah, nice leather jacket, I want what you have. Oh yeah, nice car, I want what you have. And I couldn't see anything other than the outside things to fix me. And if I could get, you know, and I came in with this hole in me that I used to keep pouring alcohol in. And I came through the 60s, so I did a lot of drugs, But alcohol was my favorite. I mean, alcohol is what I loved. Alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. I am a true alcoholic. I mean, I loved alcohol. And I never wanted to drink like a gentleman. You know, I wanted to stand at the end of the cliff and just throw myself off. And that's what it was about, just oblivion. And so I keep diverting myself. I have these little synapses that don't fire. I know I started talking about something, and I'll probably remember what it was in a minute. So outside things fixing me. And I remember going to this meeting in downtown L.A., and there was this man there. And it was a book study, and they passed the big book around, and everybody read a paragraph and then passed it on. And there was this man there, and he was obviously just learning to read. And when it came his turn to read, he stumbled through his paragraph, and people helped him with the words in it. I could not have done that. If I couldn't have read my paragraph, I would have said something like, I don't have my glasses. I'd have felt embarrassed. I'd have felt less than. I'd have felt awful. And see, that fits into the way I felt when I came to this program, because I felt very bad about who I was, and I didn't want to be embarrassed, and I didn't want anyone to know who I was, and I didn't want to make any mistakes. And I listened to this man read, and when he finished, people applauded for him, and he smiled. And I wanted that man's smile. I wanted that feeling of accomplishment that he had, and I wanted that courage that he had to just be willing to show up and do what he needed to do to stay sober for that day. And that was the first time that I got that it's not the boots that are going to fix me. It's not the leather jacket that's going to fix me. It's not any of that stuff. It really is the stuff that goes on inside. And it took me a long time to get there. You know, I've heard people say again and again, the longest journey we make is the journey from our heads to our hearts. And my head is my worst enemy. It's just my worst enemy. I have 14 years of sobriety, and I would love to tell you that my first thought is always the loving, sober, caring thought. It isn't. I think like an alcoholic. My first thought is always, who do they think they are? What are they doing to me? Why is this happening to me? I mean, it's endless for me. And maybe it's a gift. I don't know. Maybe it's a gift that I just, you know, go right for the alcoholic thought. And today, I'm very grateful that I don't have to live out that alcoholic thought. I don't have to participate in that today, because I have tools from this program, and within seconds or minutes or hours, I can turn my thinking around. And my sponsor told me right up front that I had to be a loving and forgiving person. And I hated that. I hated the whole idea of it. I wanted payback. I wanted to get even. And the big book talks about, you know, hurts real and imagined. And it didn't matter to me whether they were real or imagined. I wanted to get people back for them. And I have only two choices today. I'm either living in the solution, in which case I am truly practicing being a loving and forgiving person who has a higher power and has steps and has people I can turn to for guidance, or I'm living in my disease. And for me, my disease is about fear, it's about anger, it's about me against you, and it's very painful for me when I'm there. It's very painful for me. And I can be there without ever having to take a drink, because my disease is alive and well between my ears at any given moment. And it kind of scares me sometimes, but that's the way it is for me. And I've had a lot of problems, a lot of trouble grasping this whole idea of sobriety. And You know, one time I was at a meeting and a guy came in and he was drunk and he was loud and carrying on, and you know, people took him and got him quiet and were very caring towards him. And the guy next to me said, "Oh, I hate that. I hate that. Don't you hate that when that happens?" And I thought, you know, honestly, I don't, because that's who I am. That's what I understand. That's what I've been comfortable with all my life. You people make me uncomfortable. Sobriety makes me uncomfortable because I have to be present. I have to be accountable. I have to be a responsible person. And it's not something that comes to me naturally. You know, it's not what I do. I'm an alcoholic, and I act and think like an alcoholic. And today, I don't have to do that. I can think like one. I don't have to. I guess it's like I don't always walk the way I talk today, but I don't ever have to walk the way I think today. And I used to do that all the time. And so my lessons in this program have been small lessons at the time that have had big consequences later on in my life. You know, the way this program is set up is so amazing to me. It is just amazing because, you know, I don't know how we get 30 days. I can tell you easily how to get 14 years of sobriety. You go to meetings. You don't drink or use no matter what. You take commitments. You work with newcomers. You sponsor people. You know, you may use your phone. You call your sponsor. Sounds simple enough. You work the steps. Sounds simple. But the first 30 days of this program, I didn't have the steps. I didn't know what they were. You know, I didn't have anything other than the fact I didn't have any place else to go. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin, I didn't know what else to do. And I think it's a miracle I stuck out the 30 days. And I didn't realize it at the time, and I didn't appreciate it. And I just expected to be struck drunk again, because I didn't think I had the choice. I thought alcohol was just a part of my life. It always was, and it always will be. And I didn't have a choice about that. And at some point, no matter how hard I tried, I would be struck drunk again. And that hasn't had to happen. And my thinking, you know, my thinking is like, when I was first sober, I had a job where I had to travel quite a bit. And I used to think, well, if I'm out of the state and I drink, it doesn't count. And I don't have to go back and tell them that they'll never know. So I can just keep racking up time and drinking out of state and it'll be okay. And then I got, no, that's not okay. It's not totally honest. It's not even close to honest. And then I figured if I was in a plane, it would be okay. Because if you're not even on the planet, how can it matter? Now, this is how my alcoholic thinking goes. And the way God works in my life is, when I had decided this was it, this was the day, I'm going to drink on this plane, I'm going to buy me a bunch of those little bottles, and I'm going to sit back, and I'm just going to enjoy that burn as it goes down. And I get on the plane, and there's this very pleasant woman sitting there already, and she starts chatting and introduces herself, and she says, "I work for the National Council on Alcoholism, and I'm going to a conference." And I get to say, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I was going to drink on this plane, and I think you've ruined it for me. And that's, you know, I can't always guarantee any alcoholic that there's going to be someone to, you know, straighten them out on a plane, but I know God was working in my life even when I didn't believe that God was working in my life. I had a lot of trouble with God and accepting God and believing with God. You know, I had 13 years of Catholic school, and Sister Mary's sociopath didn't really give like this great concept of God that I could hold on to and have faith in. So that's been a real tough one for me. And every day, you know, God works in my life through the people in this program, through all different ways. And, you know, I know today that I've always had love in my life, but I could never feel it. And that didn't mean it wasn't there. It just meant I couldn't feel it, which to me was as good as it not being there. Same way when I came to these rooms, I couldn't feel the love. Didn't exist for me. And today, there are times when I am overwhelmed by the amount of love in these rooms. I was at a meeting on Saturday night out in Palmdale, and, you know, I got there, and it was kind of at a clubhouse-type place. And there was a guy in there, and he's kind of staggering around. He'd, like, walk across the room this way and then move around this way. And at one point, he wet his pants. And, you know, the things that we do behind our disease. And the people in that room just loved him. You know, they weren't judging him. They weren't saying, oh, God, there he is again, and he's peed again. You know, they were just really kind to this man. And I thought, what a wonderful program. What a wonderful place for him to be. And maybe someday, you know, I got the impression he'd been around for quite a while, and maybe someday it'll click for him. You know, I don't know what it takes. I have no idea what it takes. But maybe one day it'll click for him. And like the little things that started happening in my life, you know, prayer was a tough one for me, because I'd think, you know, well, if I get, I'd kind of want to play let's make a deal with God, you know, okay, God, I'll line up the shot, you kick it over the goalpost for me. And once I got to see that the prayers in my head were about manipulating and trying to get things from God, and when my prayers traveled down and reached my heart, and they became as simple as, right now, God, I'm little and I can't do this. I always got the help that I needed. You know, God was always there for me when it was coming from my heart. And I had a real difficult time with anger. You know, I was very, very angry when I got here. And it took a long time. And part of what that was about was me not taking care of myself, me not sharing, me not putting my hand out, me not taking commitments. I know my disease was progressive. You know, I didn't wake up guzzling a case of beer or a bottle of, you know, 151 rum with a chapstick chaser. That wasn't how I started. It built up for me, and my recovery has had to build. And you know, at first it was okay to just show up and not drink or use no matter what, and that worked for a while. And then I started getting miserable, and I saw that I had to go deeper into my program, and that was when I started sharing. And I was just so miserable I couldn't stand it anymore, and I decided I had to let you people know exactly what I thought of you. And then you could throw me away, because I knew you were hypocrites, and as soon as you heard what I thought of you, you would ditch me in a heartbeat. And I went to this meeting, and I started, I was like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, you know, and the people in the room just laughed, and they said, how much time do you have? Gee, that's great that you can be in touch with your anger like that. And I began to see that it's true what they say. You know, when they say, we'll love you till you can love yourself, no one threw me away. And I got to see that I was the one throwing me away. You know, it was so impossible for me to ask for help when I got here, and I so desperately felt like I needed help, and it was impossible for me to reach out because I was afraid I wasn't good enough, that you were going to say, why would I want to help you? And that's my mind again. You know, that's not anything I learned here. That's what I came in with in my mind. So when I found out that you people weren't going to throw me away, I could share more. Also around that time, a friend of mine is here who I met way back in the beginning, and I didn't take chips. I didn't take cakes. I would say 30 days and I haven't had any fun. 60 days and I haven't had any fun. And it was, I think it was my 2-year cake. And we were at a meeting and he surprised me. You know, they said, and now we have birthdays and we have a 2-year cake for Sharon, and I had to go up and take this cake. And all I don't even remember what I said, but it was along the lines of, my name is Sharon, I'm an alcoholic, I hate doing this, and I hate talking at these meetings, thank you, and I sat down. It was a very gracious speech. And afterwards, people came up and said, you know, I hate speaking at these meetings too, it's really hard for me. And I felt connected. One more time, I felt connected. And so sharing became really important to me. But then after a while, that wasn't enough. You know, I needed to get the commitment. I needed to get the sponsor. I needed to do... See, as an alcoholic, I want to do it my way. And I have a lifetime to prove that my way doesn't work. But I will go down to the bitter end fighting, defending my right to do it my way, no matter how miserable it makes me, and then I'll do it your way. You know, I'll do it the way that works. I'll do it the way that's gentle for me. I'll do it the way that God's world plan has it laid out. But man, you know, my motto is, it takes what it takes. And it took me a long time, and I still struggle. You know, it's my thing. Struggling for a long time was my thing, and it's a tough one to let go of. Then I'm taking commitments. And then around my fourth birthday, I realized that I really, really wanted to drink. And at this time, I was going to meetings, I had commitments, I was doing this stuff, everything I thought I should do to look good is what I was doing, you know, and I wasn't feeling good. I wasn't letting you know who I was or what was happening with me. I was just saying things that I thought you wanted me to say. I was saying things that I thought would make me be accepted. And I had to learn to say how I felt, to say what was going on with me. And I came in here with a lot of secrets. I didn't want you to know who I was. I didn't want you to know anything about me. And then I'd come to a meeting and someone would say, well, you know, you're only as sick as your secrets. And I'd go, ooh, because I had so many. You know, I had so many. And I was so afraid of letting people know what was happening with me. And that's been my salvation in this program. Because I, prior to coming here and my first couple of years, I was of the mind that I have to do everything alone. You know, I take care of myself, my way, and I don't need you. And I don't care what you think. And I've learned that I don't care. You know, I used to teach school, and I taught kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. And when those little kids would say to me, I don't care, I knew what they were saying to me is, I've already been hurt by better than you. You know, I've been hurt by better than you, and there isn't anything you can do that's going to hurt me. And that's who I was. You know, I don't care. There isn't anything you can do that's going to hurt me. And everything was hurting me. You know, I was like a raw nerve just throbbing, which is why I drank. I was afraid of everything. And life was just hard for me. I didn't get how to live life. And that's what I've been learning in these rooms. And my lessons have been... you know, one of my big lessons that, and I always like to talk about this because this was an important one for me, was my bird Lola. And I had this bird that I loved. It was the coolest parakeet I've ever seen in my life. Lola would talk and eat cheese Doritos and pick the crust off the stove. And Lola was a very special bird. And Lola got real sick and was in her cage shaking and really not doing well. And I was running around. I knew the guy around the corner had birds. I was going crazy, and I couldn't stop crying because I didn't want Lola to die. And I had to speak at a meeting, and I thought, I can't let people see me like this. You know, I don't want to go to a meeting and let people see me. This looks bad. But I had learned at that point that I don't let things keep me away from AA. You know, I show up no matter what. If I have a bad hair day, I show up. If I'm hurting, I show up. That's what I've been taught. That's what I do. And I showed up to speak at this meeting, and I cried through most of it because it just hurt me so much. about Lola. And then people, you know, you people with this endless stuff started asking me how Lola was doing. And I got home from the meeting and there were phone calls from people saying, how is she? Is she okay now? And then when people cared, it made me cry even more and I couldn't deal with it. And I really, you know, I wanted people to care, but then when they did care, it hurt me and I didn't know how to accept it. And I called my sponsor, and I said, I don't know what's going on here. I can't stop crying, and when people try to be nice or try to be comforting, it makes me cry more. And she said, it's all right, sweetheart, you're just needy. I said, I am not needy. And she said, of course you are, and until you can admit it, you're not going to get the help that you need. And there's nothing wrong with being needy. Sometimes we just need a little help in our lives. And I never got that. I never got that it was okay sometimes to just get a little bit of help in our lives. And I learned a big lesson from Lola about letting people into my life. Also, this business of being in the moment. I didn't get that. And a tuna salad sandwich that I tried to get from a restaurant and couldn't get, and I knew I was going to complain about it for the next 3 days over not getting this sandwich, when suddenly it occurred to me that I was going to waste 3 days of my life over a tuna salad sandwich because I was going to not be in the moment. I was going to stay right in that moment when that man said, you can't have the tuna salad sandwich. So I caught on that I have to let go of those things. And to me, letting go is hard. You know, letting go, I mean, this is letting go. You know, that looks simple enough, right? But the way I let go is like this. And to me, it's pretty tricky. You know, that little step beyond here is the tough part. And I had to learn about letting go. And the way this ties together for me, because those little lessons carried on to bigger lessons. And when a number of years ago my brother died, and it was the hardest time in my life, one of them, to get through. And what I decided I would do as soon as I heard about it is I would go off by myself, deal with it on my own, and when I was better and could come back and look good, I would go into the meetings that I went to and say, AA saved me. AA was there for me. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, when I knew in the back of my mind I'd be going, I did it alone. I did it alone and I didn't need any of you. And that's my alcoholism. And as soon as I started thinking that way, I got to the first meeting I could get to. And I told people what was going on, and I cried, and I did what I thought would be looked bad. You know, now how can an alcoholic talking about real feelings look bad? But that was my concept. And the people in AA loved me through that. I got so much help and support, and I can't tell you the number of people who came up and said, my brother died too. I know how hard this is. And they got me through it. And that was when I learned that my higher power was really in me, not the outside God who was judging me, that, you know, Sister Mary's psychopath and her friends all came up with, but that there was a God in me. And I remember being at my brother's wake, wondering why I wasn't curled up in a ball in the corner crying, or why I wasn't at a bar just getting as drunk as I could get, or why I wasn't just screaming for God to help me. And the answer that came back to me was that there was only one set of footprints in the sand, that I was being carried through it. You know, that all that endless crap was coming true in my life, that I was being... that I was being loved through this and carried through this. And a number of years later, in terms of being in the moment, my mother went into the hospital and she was very sick. And, you know, again, the first thing I did was get to meetings and talk about her being in the coma and talk about how bad I felt. And I couldn't believe it. You know, that night, the first night I shared about it, there were three people in that room who were going through exactly the same thing. I mean, where do you find that? You know, and I had to go back to New Jersey to be with my mother, and they called me. You know, people called me back there to let me know how they were doing and to talk about what was happening with them and to see how I was doing. And I wasn't alone. You know, one of the big miracles for me today is that I don't have to do anything alone. There is always a loving person there for me. There is always a loving God there for me. And I don't always believe that. A number of months ago, because of all the stuff going on in our city, I'm a contractor, and the possibility that my job might be terminated came up. The possibility, not the reality, but the possibility. And this plunged me into fear like I haven't felt in so long. I can't even tell you. That empty feeling, that hole, came back again, and I was all about trying to fill it with money or security or whatever. And that's my alcoholism. The fear of the possibility of something happening, and I'm already scrambling, trying to, you know, I mean, it was crazy. And I was back into that insanity, you know, that I know for a fact the second step, I have been restored to sanity. I just don't always act that way. And I was having a tough time then. And I said, yeah, this is it. I got to get to my women's meeting. I got to dump. I got to get this out of me. And I get to this meeting, and the women start sharing. And one was sharing about her daughter who was dying. And she was afraid of what her life was going to be like when her daughter died. And I thought, you know, that's a real fear. And another woman had 3 years of sobriety, and she went back out, and she had 12 days now, and her mother had died the night before, and she was afraid of drinking. And I thought, that's a real fear. You know, that's a real fear. And another woman there had had a brain hemorrhage, and she was afraid that if she had another one, she was going to die. And I thought, you know, that's a real fear. And I was sitting in this meeting listening to these women, and I just started crying because I realized that that hole in me that I had tried throughout my life to fill with alcohol, with people, with places, with things, with all of that stuff, was once again being filled up with faith and courage and love, which, you know, what a great thing. And I didn't have to dump. There was nothing for me to dump because I had been filled. I had received what I needed. And it reminds me of you know, my husband and I were on vacation, and we went to a church in Chimayo. And when I first walked into this little church, they have healing dirt there, and the people in the area go for healing. And there's like 5 minutes, crutches and wedding cake tops and baby shoes and all of these things in there. And I first went in and I thought, I can't stand the pain in here. I can't stand the pain. And within seconds, I realized that that church wasn't filled with pain. It was filled with faith. It was filled with faith. And I loved being there. I felt so happy being in that church and being surrounded by so much faith. Because that's one of my weak points. You know, when this thing, my fear started, what I got was it was time for me to go deeper into my spiritual program. It was time for me to develop a more conscious contact with my higher power. And I go through these phases, you know. I'll say, oh, I'm not comfortable, I'm miserable, I hate this, and I'm doing everything the program recommends, and I'm still, if the program's not working, you know, I used to do this all the time. I don't, you know, but this is, I used to do this, it's not working. And what I would neglect is that I was not making the amends I needed to make or not doing the writing that I needed to do, or, you know, there was always something that could turn it around for me, making the phone call, doing something like that. And any time I let go of something, it leaves an empty spot there. And at first, that empty spot used to confuse me and hurt me and scare me because I would think something bad was going to have to come and fill it, because that was my experience about life, was bad things happened. And when the thought of my job ending came up, it was like a good thing couldn't come of this, only a bad thing could come of it. And what I see today is that what happens in God's world, if I stay connected to my program, good things come of it. I have nothing but proof that says God is there for me, that faith is what does it, that AA is what does it. Thank you.